from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with award-winning author Christina Baker Klein, whose novel The Exiles came out in paperback this month from Custom House. A number one New York Times best-selling author of 8 novels, including The Exiles, Orphan Train, and A Piece of the World, Christina Baker Klein is published in 40 countries. Her novels have received the New England Prize for Fiction, the Maine Literary Award, and a Barnes & Noble Discover Award, among other prizes, and have been chosen by hundreds of communities, universities, and schools as One Book, One Read selections. Her essays, articles, and reviews have appeared in publications such as The New York Times and The New York Times Book Review, The Boston Globe, The San Francisco Chronicle, Lit Hub, Psychology Today, and Slate. The Exiles concerns 3 women whose lives are bound together in 19th century Australia and the hardships they weather together as they fight for redemption and freedom in a new society. Seduced by her employer's son, Evangeline, a naive young governess in early 19th century London, is discharged and sent to the notorious Newgate Prison when her pregnancy is discovered. After months in the fetid, overcrowded jail, she learns she is sentenced to the land beyond the seas, Van Diemen's Land, a penal colony in Australia. During the journey on a repurposed slave ship, the Medea, Evangeline strikes up a friendship with Hazel, a girl little older than her former pupils, who was sentenced to 7 years transport for stealing a silver spoon. Though Australia has become home to Aboriginal people for more than 50,000 years, the British government in the 1840s considers its fledgling colony uninhabited and unsettled, and views the natives as an unpleasant nuisance. By the time the Medea arrives, many of them have been forcibly relocated, their land seized by white colonists. One of those relocated people is Mathina, the orphaned daughter of the chief of the Laurene tribe, who has been adopted by the new governor of Van Diemen's Land. In The Exiles, Christina Baker Klein recreates the beginnings of a new society in a beautiful and challenging land, telling the story of Australia from a fresh perspective through the experiences of Evangeline, Hazel, and Mathina. While life in Australia is punishing and often brutally unfair, it is also, for some, an opportunity for redemption, for a new way of life, for unimagined freedom. The novel has been optioned for television by Bruna Papandrea, the producer of HBO's Big Little Lies. My interview with Christina Baker Klein begins with my first question. I hope you enjoy our conversation. In your acknowledgments, you write, attempting to identify the genesis of a novel can be a fool's errand. I thought that was really true. On the other hand, you do go on to offer some of the book's roots, and I wonder if you can just lead us through a little of what brought about The Exiles.
Oh, sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Great.
So when I say that it's a fool's errand, what I mean is that you often don't know why you're drawn to a subject right away. And I've learned as a writer that it's best right when you start, not even to probe that deeply into why you love something, but instead to follow the threads. And so it wasn't until I was well into the book that I realized that these disparate strands of my own life story had led me to it. I first read, so this is how it happened, that the thing that I didn't quite understand was that I read a New York Times article a number of years ago. It was by, there's a journalist named Lisa Belkin, who's wonderful. She often writes about parenting. It was a parenting column. It used to be called Motherload, which I don't think it would be called today. But she always wrote about issues with raising children, and I had 3 boys, so I read it. And this particular week was unusual in that she focused on convict women on these repurposed slaving ships traveling to Australia with children aboard and how difficult it was. I think she was sort of making a point about how much we might complain these days. It's not as bad as it was. And I felt this tingle. I just thought, this is an incredible story that most Americans certainly don't know much about. Mm-hmm. And so that it was instant. I just knew. But I was already, you know, I often have ideas when I'm already working on books. So I was already working on books, but I started gathering sort of material, and I went down this rabbit hole and found this incredible historian named Allison Alexander, who has a website. She is sort of the world expert on the convict women. She's written 35 books, most of which are only available in Australia, but they're about the convict women, and they're about Sir John Franklin and Lady Franklin, who feature in my novel, because we'll talk about it later, but because they were, he was the governor of Hobart, where lots of these convict women came, and also because they took in an Aboriginal girl as a sort of social experiment that features in my book as well. So that was the beginning. That was the spark. But I later realized that my own trip to Australia in my formative 20s for 6 weeks was really important to me. And I had read Robert Hughes's enormous and very beautiful book, The Fatal Shore, which is a history of Australia. But he only devotes one chapter in that book to the convict women and Aboriginal people together. The book is 700 pages. So that was the chapter that intrigued me the most. And so I'd sort of had this percolating thought in the back of my head, although I came back to America after this I was a Rotary Foundation fellow. I came back to the States. I wrote a book with my mom about the women's movement. She was a women's studies professor, and we interviewed 60 women. And in the course of that, I discovered that these powerful stories that should be a part of the history we study, are actually often left out of the history books if they're by women or the poor or the dispossessed. And so that led me to what has become my career in a way of writing, telling little known stories, particularly women's stories. And then finally, I taught in two women's prisons, most recently memoir writing in the only all-female prison in the state of New Jersey. And that was a really important experience for me. I learned a lot about the criminal justice system, and I got really involved in sort of the rights of, well, foster kids who often end up in prison, and the incarcerated. Mm-hmm. So that's a very long answer, but those are all the parts, I think, that sort of most directly led me to this really interesting story.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, but I don't think it's too long an answer. I also think people really like hearing how someone comes to a novel, because it can be hard to figure out what you're going to write about, you know, or you have too much input and you have too many ideas. So I think that's a great story of how you came to write The Exiles.
For anyone who is writing a novel or who wants to write fiction, I would say that what I've learned, this is my eighth novel, and my first five were contemporary. And I had an editor. My book sort of did well, each one, it was sort of an up and down for a while. I always was able to get published. I had an agent. That wasn't the issue. It was, and I was, to be honest with you, completely happy as a mid-list author, meaning I never presumed that I would be more than that. I wanted to just write. And so I crafted a life around writing. I taught, I got qualified to, you know, teach at the college level. I taught full-time for years, and I worked as a freelance editor for years. And so my kids, my three boys are all in the arts, unfortunately for them, but they're in their early 20s. But I always say, you know, you can love what you do, but you have to have a marketable skill. And maybe you'll make a living at the art, but maybe you'll need to bolster it with something else. So when my novel Orphan Train took off, it was a complete surprise, really. But I had a conversation with an editor about my previous novels that I think lodged in my brain in a way that I didn't even realize at the time. And we were talking about, I basically screwed up the courage to say why, to ask her why one of my novels just didn't launch very well. And it's since gone on to do well. And I actually liked the novel a lot. But her point was, she said, you need, I mean, this is kind of gross, but she said, you need to write like a man, is what she said. But what she really was saying is, you need to be more ambitious in your canvas. You need to take on projects that scare you. You need to step outside of, quote unquote, what you know, which is what writers are always told to write about, and move into areas that are challenging and terrifying. And furthermore, she said, you really need to have character, you're a step removed from your characters, she sort of said. You need to have characters who are viscerally engaged with the reader. You need to have characters that to root for in one way or another, which doesn't mean they have to be entirely likable. It just means that you need to be engaged with them on a viscerally emotional level.
Yeah.
And that was really good advice.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't planned to ask this question, but since you've just said that, you know, you have a character named Buck in this novel who is a bad person, pretty much always doing terrible things in the novel. But there is this moment at the end, and I don't give away endings, but there is a moment at the end where someone sees him with a certain amount of compassion. And I felt like that was so smart. That made me, for that moment, wonder what his background was. You know, I hadn't really cared up until that moment, right? So I just feel like that's important to present well-rounded characters that do have, you know, some potential background that we may or may not know about that makes us more invested in who they are.
My husband and I were watching Big Little Lies, the two seasons. I don't know if you've seen it, but the production team that did that that did Big Little Lies and Wild and Gone Girl and The Undoing are doing Exiles.
Oh.
So we were really curious about how they develop character. And we were, when we finished the last episode of the second and then final so far, at least season, we were talking about exactly that, about how they use small moments to introduce complexity into characters that is a big glossy production, but I actually think they did a beautiful job with character because each one has this several moments of rounding that make them neither all good or all bad.
Yeah, I did watch that. And I felt like bringing Meryl Streep in as the mother of this abhorrent person who was in the first season makes us think more about who he is. And then there's even a point in the second season where you kind of start to wonder who she is, you know, and it's
very much. And you also see the legacy of abuse and you understand the root of his own dysfunction, which that's what we were talking about in particular with the novel I'm working on now. But how you build that in and how you expand character, which is one of the things in The Exiles that was so important to me, because a lot of terrible things happen to the convict women, but you really want to see them as humans and to Methena as well, the Aboriginal girl in the book.
Now, I wanted to ask about your characters. Which of your characters is based on an actual historical figure and who is completely invented, although perhaps drawing on history?
I've sort of learned in my novels set in the past to draw on some real characters and to invent others. In my last novel, A Piece of the World, which was about Andrew Wyeth and his relationship with Christina Olsen, who is the subject of his best-known painting, Christina's World, everybody in that book was real. And I mean, almost to a person. And that was actually so hard. And some of those people are still alive. And in fact, Jamie Wyeth, Andrew Wyeth's son, who's also a renowned artist, painter, did an event with me. And we talked about exactly that, about fiction and reality. But that kind of process is very hard. So in this novel, Methena, who is the young Aboriginal daughter of a chieftain, so considered sort of a princess by the white people, the British people who come in, is taken in by Sir John and Lady Franklin. And this all is true, a true story. In my novel, I made her 8 to 12 instead of 5 to 8 or 9, because I wanted her to have a more developed consciousness. In real life, she was about 5 to 9 when these events occurred. But in Australia, she's quite well known because she's become a symbol of what happened to the Aboriginal people, how their land was stolen. They were pushed into these essentially open air concentration camps and starved and mistreated. And in fact, in Tasmania, by the mid-1860s, there were no full-blooded Aboriginal people left, and there had been thousands at the turn of the 19th century. So Methena's story is very powerful and indicative of the larger picture. She's real.
And I looked up the painting by Thomas Bach, and I saw, you know, that there is this painting of Methena. Is that her? Is that the person? That's her. Yeah.
And on my website, there's a whole section devoted to Methena, and you can see other pictures of her as well. There were other portraits made of her, but that's the most famous and the most well-known. And on my website, too, this Sydney dance troupe called the Bangara Dance Company has a dance called Mithina, and it tells the story of her life. And she wears the red dress that she wears in the Thomas Bach portrait. And it's online and quite powerful. Mm-hmm. So she was real. The Franklins are real. Elizabeth Fry, who was a Quaker reformer who tried to ameliorate conditions for female convicts on their way to in London before they get on the ships to Australia. She was very involved in sort of convict rights. At the same time that she was very religious and judgmental, there was, she was a complicated character. I tried to convey that. But my convict women are essentially composites. I mean, I read lots and lots of stories, but I wanted to begin the novel with a character who feels like in some ways a stand-in for the reader. She's literate, like the reader. She can read. She reads lots of books. She's read Shakespeare and her poetry. She grew up with her vicar father in a sort of bubble of literacy, and she didn't really have any practical skills. So when he died and she was orphaned, her mother had died when she was very young, she's thrust on her own and she doesn't really know what to do. She becomes a governess and is falsely accused of a crime and ends up on the way to Newgate Prison. And there's a moment in the novel, and again, I chose her as the entree for the reader because I thought everything that happens to her is a fresh shock. So like the reader, she's experiencing for the first time what it likes to have this sudden shift in class, social status in class, whereas the other convict women, most of them have been in this world for a long time. So she's sitting in a carriage on the way to Newgate Prison. She can't even believe what's happened to her. And it's freezing cold. And she unconsciously, she's chained, her hands are chained. She shifts closer to the constable sitting next to her and he flinches in revulsion. And she, there's a moment where I think my line is something like, for the first time, she realizes what it means to be contemptible. Yeah, and that's something she's never experienced. And so as she descends into the down the steps into Newgate Prison, I felt like she was heading down into Hades and she's bringing the reader along with her. She's based on any number of 19th century, you know, characters and women that you read about, that I've read, short novels that I've read.
There was, since you mentioned Mrs. Fry and your character Evangeline, I loved this moment. You have this moment where Mrs. Fry and some of the other Quaker women come to give the convict women some gifts and really some hope and some chance at dignity and some thought about there could be a future for them. And I loved how this moment of kindness on the part of Mrs. Fry offers Evangeline sort of the strength to, she shifts in that very scene into feeling protective of this child that she's carrying. She's pregnant and she's carrying a child and she's been very sort of, ambivalent about that up until this point. I loved that that moment happened where there's like kindness is shown to her. And so she can go on in a way, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I loved that.
To have kindness shown in a setting where you're having to protect yourself against everything that's coming at you can feel very disorienting. And that was one of the things I took from teaching in the women's prison. We were, most of the women, there were about 15 in my group, and they were in supermax. So they had committed crimes that meant they were not getting out for a long time. Some of them were lifers and some were there for a few decades. I had one woman who was really my TA, and she had been there for 40 years. And I later learned what she had done. It was a heinous crime, but she was a human and lovely. But so what I learned in that experience was most of these women had never told their stories even. And they were in my class, we called it the bubble. They were writing and sharing their work about their lives. And of course, most of them had been abused, physically, sexually abused. And also they had never had an opportunity to sort of experience kindness about what had happened to them and even what they had done. And I think that was a powerful lesson for me. And I wanted to show that in the novel.
Yeah.
So it's interesting just to, again, for writers who are out there thinking about their own life experiences, you never know how your own life experiences will factor into a novel. And so I advise you and I advise my children too, to live broadly, to travel, to to grab experiences, because all of that can become fodder for you in unexpected ways.
I was curious, was Britain the only country or set of countries that sent women convicts to Australia?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were it.
Yeah, and the funny thing was, both France and the Dutch had come, the French and the Dutch had come there first, and neither of them sort of planted a flag and said, we own this country. Britain came in and said, okay, bye everyone, we're, you know, taking over. That was just the way they went around the world. And they did it everywhere. In fact, before they sent 50,000 convicts to America before we declared independence. And then they realized, and then by the 1780s, we had had enough and said, nope, no more convicts. So Britain at first considered Africa, the coast of Africa, but they couldn't find a port that was secure enough. And then they looked to Australia and they just marched over there and started depositing male convicts. And by 1803, Australia was 9-1 men to women. And the British government had a problem. They had a penal colony that was dying out, but they didn't have a colony that was self-subsidizing. And so they started trafficking in women and bringing them over under the flimsiest of pretenses. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a remarkable story, and only the Brits can do this.
Yes. Yeah.
It was that colonizing impulse that was so deeply ingrained in the British culture,
right,
that led to this whole creation of a community there.
Yeah. Now, the book takes place between 1840 and 1868, but mostly 1840 to 1843, I think, is mostly where the book takes place. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about finding the voice of a different historical time period. Now, this is not quite as different as if you went back to the 15th century or something, but finding the voice of a different time period and keeping it accessible, and how that was for you in this case.
That was the hugest challenge, of course. And how do you convey the cadence of language of the conversations between a Glaswegian and a Londoner from the bottom rungs of society? How do you show those? I decided not to use dialect. I tried to convey sound just through the construction of the sentences, where the nouns and verbs fall. But more than anything, I wanted the novel to feel contemporary. This does not resemble novels that are written about the convict women in the 1840s. And I've read some. There were a ton of exclamation points and there was a ton of dialect in those books. It was a whole different kind of thing. I read an interview with Hilary Mantel, who wrote Wolf Hall and wonderful books that, as you said, take place longer time ago. And she said, my ambition was to write contemporary novels set in the past. And that was my ambition as well. I mean, that struck home to me because I wanted to write novels that felt as if you are plonked down in the middle of this world, but it's not entirely unfamiliar to you, that you understand the language and you're not having to fight to sort of hear in your own head what the characters are saying. So the way they speak, I tried not to use anachronistic words in their conversation, for example. Of course I do in some of the description that is my own, but in their heads and in their conversations, I don't. I also use some terms that the sailors used, and that was really fun to do. But I think their dialogue is actually probably a combination of contemporary speak and the way people spoke back then. I did a deep dive into what that was like then, and I just had to forge my own way through it, draft after draft. So I want, again, my goal really was that the book be as immediate as possible and for a contemporary reader to feel like you're on that boat with those women.
Yeah. Speaking of the boat, I wonder if do you mind very much if I read a quick thing?
No, please.
So this is a moment where a woman has just given birth. Okay. And the sensory detail takes place between two really important events in the novel. Okay. So here's what you write. Oh, you know what? Why don't you read it?
Okay. Do you want me to read this paragraph?
Yes, please.
Okay, great. So this is right after a character has given birth. A baby's piercing cry. She lifted her head. Time flattened, widened. Her senses returned. She smelled the fishy odor of the whale oil in the lamps, the muttony candle wax, the iron sweetness of her own blood. She gazed up at the wide beams in the ceiling, nailed in place by long iron spikes, heard the soft patter of rain on the deck, the last remnants of the storm.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Those are such, I mean, just in and of itself, standing alone, that paragraph is beautiful and is so filled with perfect details. But in particular, because it takes place between two very important events, which I'm not going to go into, but I just wonder if you can talk about the value of sensory detail and maybe most importantly, smell in conveying a moment of import.
So important. And when I have my students do writing exercises, I often tell them to try to consciously use the five senses in the first paragraph. And then that paragraph may be cut eventually, but it immediately opens your own awareness, opens your own, as a writer, it opens your own senses. So in a book like this, which is so dependent on the granular details of an experience, keeping consciously aware of the five senses as I wrote was really important. And that detail about the candle wax, oh my gosh, I use it throughout the book because this is a great example of research. Okay. I did a lot of research for maybe a year, year and a half, went to Australia twice, read a million books, interviewed all these people, went to all these places. And, from prisons to manor homes on which the governor's house is based. I went to London, I went to Glasgow, I went to Tunbridge Wells, I went to the spot where Newgate Prison used to stand. But it wasn't until I had already written about 150 pages maybe that I stumbled on a detail about how in the homes of the poor and in prisons, the candles were made of animal fat that had, now I can't remember either a high or a low burning point. So they melted really fast and they puddled on the floor and they smelled terrible. And it was a meaty, muttony smell, the lowest form of like the slaughterhouse, all the leftover bits and pieces that became candles for the poor and the prisons. And it was such a visceral detail. And I remember reading about Newgate Prison. I describe it she's walking along in Newgate too, that Evangeline had never smelled this. She had never been in the house at the house of someone burning a candle like this, or in a prison, obviously. And it was a pervasive smell. So I wanted to convey what that was like because I thought it would immediately capture that feeling. And in the Cascades prison that they end up in Australia, as you might imagine, it was in a valley. So it became really soggy during rainy season and it was moldy, you know, and I just needed to get across what that was like to live in those conditions. I know it sounds awful and the whole novel is not that terrible. And in fact, there are great moments of delight in nature and in the surrounding areas and in Tasmania and Australia as a whole. And in some ways in every way, it's an entirely different universe for these women. And they get to see the brightness of flowers they've never imagined and animals they've never contemplated and 7 foot tall kangaroos and things like that with joeys sticking out of their pockets.
And just the sheer change in weather from going from London to Tasmania, like just crazy.
That was crazy. And it really was entering a new world. So I use The Tempest as a kind of parallel story. And because my characters all in one way or another are touched by the story of The Tempest. And in 1840, it was the most popular Shakespeare play that was performed outdoors for free for audiences. So I knew that I wanted these women to have seen it in different places and different times. And The Tempest is one of the stories in the book, one of the pieces that's passed from one woman to the next as well. But in The Tempest, they're on these storm-tossed seas and they end up on this magical island. And that was really what happened to the convict women.
Yeah. So soon after the scene that you just read, that paragraph of wonderful detail, the worlds that we've been in sort of come together. So you've been narrating from two points of view, Evangeline's and Mathena's. And then these two worlds come together in an interesting way. And I wonder if you can talk about bringing two narratives together. It's clear that as we've been reading along, we were getting to the point where these were going to converge. And so there's a certain amount of excitement and tension as a reader as you come toward it. So anyway, any thoughts on that?
That's always an interesting question. In my novel, Orphan Train, there's a conceit that some people get it on the first page of the book, and some people actually never get it. And then most people understand it at a certain point. So the conceit is that there's a third person story, which is the present day story, which is 2/3 of the book. And then there's a first person story about the orphan train. And you realize at a certain point that the old woman who's 91, who rode on the orphan trains, is telling the story to a 17-year-old girl. And at a certain point, they end up in chairs side by side. And you realize that she's telling the story. But a lot of people didn't see it for a long time. And yet others said it, they could see it from the beginning. So it's always interesting when you have stories that match up at some point in a book. I'm one of those denser readers. It's one reason I'm not a great thriller reader. I often just don't see people say, oh, I knew right away. And I don't really read books that way. I think that's the secret. I'm always caught tripped up in language and structure. I'm really paying attention to all that stuff. And I don't really care exactly about the twist so much. Although, of course, that can be exciting too. So in this novel, when I went to this manor house called Runnymede in Hobart, Tasmania, and Alison Alexander, this historian, took me there and said, this is very similar to what the governor's house was like. And convict women worked in this house, and it's part of their whole thing now. It's a part of the National Register, and they have tours. And I just thought, of course convict women worked in this house, and this is where Mathena lives. It makes perfect sense that one of my characters would end up there with her and that the stories can intersect. It was this great aha moment.
I love those.
I do too, as I was coming up with the book and figuring out how it would all fit together. And I'm not great at structure. As I said, I'm always obsessed with language and character. And so I often will use a firm structure. So for example, with my very first novel, Sweetwater, nobody really knows this. Only one critic out of about 50 reviews for that novel noticed or figured it out or wrote it, but it's based on the Oresteia by Aeschylus. So it's the three plays of the Oresteia are the structure of my novel. And I even use the names from the Oresteia. I give them modern versions of those names. So Orestes is Horace and Cassandra is Cassie and, whatever. But so I use the Oresteia. There was this great book called Save the Cat. And I would say my most literary novel is probably A Piece of the World, which again is about Andrew Wyeth. And that book is a screenwriting guide. And so I was writing this quite interior story and that has no plot. It's about a woman who sits in her house for 50, 75 years. And so I was able to dredge a plot by using this very commercial framework, even though it's way deeply hidden. For The Exiles, I used for the first time Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, but I mapped it through three characters. So I have the journey unfold and all those highs and lows are in there, but they're kind of... So the matchup with Mathena and Hazel eventually in the book was sort of part of that story, part of that plot structure.
Okay. Now, we have to talk about research. In your acknowledgments, you go into some detail about the research you did in preparing to write this book, and you've talked a little bit about it already, but, just that sounds like a job in itself, although I can tell you love it, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So a couple of things. First of all, other than reading lots of books, which you did, you read lots and lots of books, where else did you look? And also, I'm curious if you tend to always be reading alongside the drafting of a novel, or if you try to get that out of the way before you start writing.
A lot of people don't read as they're writing. I like to read, but I often will find a book that's sort of a talisman that I like. For example, when I was writing a novel called Bird in Hand, which was about a complicated foursome relationship, I had Michael Cunningham's book, The Hours, which I just found so gorgeously written. And I would open it at random in the morning before work and just read a paragraph. And it would sort of inspire me with language and complexity in all these ways. So I do read in that way as I'm writing. I try to cut back on books that aren't inspiring to me, or books I have to read for duty reasons or whatever. I often will stop saying yes to requests to do events or blurbs or whatever, unless it kind of directly feeds my own story. But I also find, in addition to real physical books, and I have a whole shelf right now for my next book that I'm working on. I always have a shelf. But I also find the internet really useful. And so there were all kinds of ship captains, well, actually surgeons' logs, because the surgeons were the ones who kept track of what was happening on ships.
Oh, sure.
You can find those online. The time period I was writing about, the 1840s, there are a lot of books in the Gutenberg collection because they're out of copyright. So I had access to all kinds of contemporaneous novels and nonfiction books. And Wikipedia is really helpful. I mean, I don't rely on it only, but there's a lot of material. If you go to Mithinna in Wikipedia, you'll find tons of links that I was able to follow. That was how I found the Bankera Dance Theater and all of this other stuff that's been happening around her. And it actually led me to a novel called Wanting by Richard Flanagan that is about Mithinna. Mm-hmm. And he kind of twins her story with Charles Dickens, which is interesting. But so I just would follow, trends, ideas, notes. I did these tours, as I told you, of the women's prisons, of the male prisons as well in Australia, and then of museums and manor houses. And I took notes, and those were really useful when I got home as well. And then all my notes from teaching in the prison, I had considered writing a memoir called At the End of Freedom Road, because believe it or not, the road to the prison is ironically Freedom Road.
Really?
And yeah, it's crazy. It's so...
Makes more sense when they get out.
Well, I was thinking, if you're leaving, it's one thing. If you're pulling up, it's not the same. But I took all these notes. I would pull over to the side of the road. I had an hour trip back to my home, and I would pull over to the side of the road and write for about an hour after I did each one. So I had all these notes. And I even had some notes from the women. So that was useful too. Yeah. And when I'm working on a book, I feel like a magpie, and everything that comes toward me, there are often ways that things, even articles in the newspaper, that might find their way in some way or another.
So one thing I was really impressed by is you did all this research, you did all this reading, and yet I didn't feel like it was a research heavy novel. Do you know what I mean? That muttony candle wax was a perfect inclusion of a detail. And as you say, maybe you've sprinkled it throughout so that it helps to fill out scenes. But sometimes people use their research in ways that just becomes really cumbersome. And we have to learn all about the rending of the fat that made the candles, right? So, I mean, it's just, did you have to throw away any of the details?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's this great line. I can't remember who reviewed a book by Gore Vidal. It was someone huge, like Norman Mailer or Saul Bellow. And he said, no bauble, no button, no flounce of the gown goes unremarked. it was a really damning review about some novel based in the past. And I just thought, that's exactly what I don't want to do. I think that people... I'm pretty particular about the novels I read that are set in the past because I don't like it. I don't like feeling that a writer is feeling the need to shovel all this historical research toward the reader. And I was absolutely ruthless with myself about cutting anything that didn't directly have to do with my characters. And also just all the research I did that was fascinating, but not directly relevant. I didn't want it in there. I wanted all of that to feel like you're living in this place, you're experiencing it. She herself in that scene, the new mother, would smell the candle wax and smell mutton. It's not that I'm describing it from the outside and saying these candles were blah, 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 blah.
Right. Right. So, and she gazes up and those nails are long iron spikes. I mean, that was wonderful. And as I read that, I was like, what a wonderful detail. That's fantastic. But I never felt like, oh, she's researched this. And so now she's throwing in a lot of ship building lingo. No, that was just
a lot of ship stuff. And I even had a diagram of how exactly the ship looked and was put together with the orlop deck way underneath. And, you know, where did where did the captain and the crew live? And then what happened on the top? And where were all the barnyard animals? There were all these animals. But none of that really ended up in the book. They go down corridors and they go around corners, but it's not, I don't ever really describe what the whole book, the whole ship looks like.
Right.
And again, you can find that online, but I wanted you to feel like you were living the story, not that you're reading. So it's not quite like reading a nonfiction book about something. And I guess if you want to learn more, you'll go find that. And it's not hard to find.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to ask, you did mention that you have a shelf. What are you working on next? Or do you not like to talk about that?
Well, I don't mind talking about it. And sometimes I talk about it in a much more short way. But I'll tell you my one sentence description that is, okay. This is based on a family story. My mother's great-great aunts were sisters, Sarah and Adelaide Yates, who lived in Civil War era North Carolina. And they married two brothers who happened to be sideshow freaks in a traveling circus. And their names were Chang and Ang Bunker. They
really?
Were the original Siamese twins. My mother's great-great aunts. We call them that, but it's technically first cousin several times removed.
Wow.
Yeah, they had 21 children. They lived on adjoining hillsides. Every 3 days, the men went back and forth between the homes, and it was very complicated. And I'm telling the sister's story. So it's the two women alternating first-person narratives, and it's called The Foursome. And it's about what that was like.
Yeah. Wow. That's a fascinating story. And to have a personal connection is wonderful. That's really cool.
I know. I've known about the story forever because it's part of our family lore, but I've sort of worked my way into more courageous and bigger stories. And so after I wrote The Exiles, which takes place, as you know, in the 19th century, I realized I kind of can't not tell this story. I have to tell this story. So that's what I'm doing.
That's great. So then also, I like to ask if people have read anything lately that they would recommend to listeners, just one or two titles, any books that you might recommend.
Yeah, I read all the time. Two books I read recently that take place in New England are both edited by a friend of mine, Josh Bodwell at Godin, which is a really interesting press. He's executive editor there. He's a new editor. He has been there not that long, a few years. And he just edited two books that are both spectacular. Meredith Hall, Beneficence, about a Maine family with a tragedy that happens, a farm family. It feels to me a lot like Marilyn Robinson, Housekeeping.
Oh, wow.
And it's spectacular. I'm going to do an event with her in September. I feel privileged to do so because I think she's so incredible. And then another book that just came out, which is Simon Van Bui's Night Came with Many Stars. And so this is a shout out to New England authors. But Beneficence by Meredith Hall, which has a new cover, is coming out in paperback in September with a gorgeous new cover, although I like this one too. And then this is the advanced, I've blurbed both these books because I love them so much. Actually, this one, Josh Bodwell sent to me, just said, oh, I thought something you might like. And I read it and then I wrote him a note about it. And he said, can we put it on the book? And I'm like, okay. And then look at this, Simon Van Bui, the author, whom I don't know, wrote me in like, I think he did this with a quill pen.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
With an August Wilson stamp. And then the most beautiful Grand Hotel of Oslo stationery.
Wow. Look at that.
I know. I mean, very old school. And again, the most gorgeously written book. And I'll just read you the first line because it catapults the story. In Kentucky, 1933, Carol's daddy lost his 13-year-old daughter in a game of cards.
And that's from The Night Came with Many Stars?
That's from Simon Van Bui, Night Came with Many Stars.
Okay, that sounds
good. There you go.
So wonderful.
Not perhaps beach reads. if you want a great beach read, I would suggest, I have never read Ellen Hildebrand before, but she just did an event with me and she has the most passionate fans and her new book is called Golden Girl. And I devoured it in about an hour, no, in about a day. And it was the perfect book to read in a beach chair. they call her the Queen of the Beach Reads, and now I know why.
Let's see. I want to talk about an aspect of the plot without actually giving anything away. There are two moments in particular in this book where people are about to undergo really, really important transitions from one part of their lives to another, against their will in both cases. And you did this really interesting thing. In both cases, you offer the characters the opportunity to just let go and not fight what's happening. So in one case, a character withdraws into herself and imagines a physical journey that she's taking, meandering along a path to a place she knows as she's about to undergo this huge transition. And in this other case, a character decides there's no point in feeling afraid, and she imagines herself literally tipping forward and falling into her future. And, you know, these felt like very linked moments to me. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit. They were lovely moments, even though in some case, in both cases, they were against their will, but they were sort of letting go. And I suppose I noticed them because I had made a note about the first one, and then the second one kind of jumped off the page at me, and I thought these are linked in some way. So I wonder if you can talk about creating connections between stories in a narrative by using language and imagery that links them.
Yeah, those were very much connected for me. The first one, in a story like this, one of the things I was struck by as I did research is that no one had an easy path and anything could happen at any time. And I wanted the reader to have a sense of disequilibrium. I wanted the reader to understand that no one gets a pass from the kinds of experiences that happened to these women. And the most capricious events occurred in the stories I read. And that idea that one moment you think you're living a certain kind of life and then suddenly that shifts is something that was true for all the convict women, but it was viscerally felt by a number of them. And I wanted the reader, I read an interview with J.R.R. Martin, you know, about Game of Thrones, where he said, I want my readers to know that anything is possible and nothing's off the table, because it creates a world where you're always wondering kind of what's going to happen next. Sometimes you read novels and the arc is even plot-based novels where the arc is so clear, you're sure that people are going to end up in a certain direction, and they do. So I wanted to snip that idea in the bud. And then in the second instance, I'll talk about it more specifically because it's a true story. Mathina, who really existed, and I am tortured over this because I don't know if I made the right decision in how I handled her story in the very end of it. In real life, and this gives nothing away because it's not in my novel, but in real life, she drowned. As a teenager, she was found dead at the age of 17 in a stream, and she had either been murdered, or it was suicide, or it was a drunken accident. Nobody knows, but it was a tragic early end to her life. And she had been cast out by the Franklins, which is part of my story, and I don't mind telling it here because you can read it on Wikipedia. But she had been cast out and then wandered between two worlds and never had a place to call home. She went back to her people. Their numbers were decimated. She didn't speak the language anymore. She wasn't part of that world. And the white people didn't accept her. So she ended up in a former convict prison, which was a terrible place. She was in an orphanage. They put her in an orphanage, right? From living in their fancy house. They had her brought in a cart to an orphanage where she was considered an unruly, misbehaving child. And it just went downhill from there. So I wanted to end on a moment of connection. And I did, between her and Hazel, where they have an encounter in town. And it's clear that the path isn't great, but she and Hazel have this bond. They'd already had this bond, and Hazel asked her to come with her. And Mathina says, I kind of have to just do it alone. But it's not exactly a resolution, because I didn't want to pull the reader through her death. I didn't want to have another character with a tragic ending. And I felt like I had all this compassion for Mithgeta, and I just didn't. And also it was outside the time frame of, as you know, of the story for those 3 to 4 years. I wonder if I could have affected a scene toward the end where Mithgeta shows up on the doorstep at Hazel's house and Hazel lets her in. It just feels like maybe that would have been a more positive way to end that. I'm tortured over it. But
oh, interesting.
But what I wrote was kind of accurate to what really happened. It was more accurate to what really happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's unfair or trivializing to offer a happy ending for a historical figure who didn't have one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's what it felt like to me. But I do know that it hurt. When you write a book, you know, I have a lot of readers and some of them have such emotional reactions to this book. It's heartbreaking. And I feel bad about it. But this was a true story and some of the stories had really happy endings and some didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I thought it was just right. We are almost out of time, but I did want to mention one other thing. And the other thing is you did this other thing so well. There is a man in this book, not Buck, someone else, who does a bad thing. But he's constitutionally incapable of seeing himself as culpable. And you got him so perfectly. Do you know what I'm talking about? You nailed it. I was so impressed by that scene because, again, you know, I mean, there were lots of ways you could have taken it. There were ways that you could have either let him off the hook or softened things in another way. It was so just right. So.
For me, at the very end, I had the satisfying opportunity to give a real ending. And oftentimes I'll end a book and people say, I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen to the characters and what happens next. And can you write a sequel? So here I was able to write 26 years later to sort of show you what happened to these characters. And it was so satisfying to essentially end the book in the place I started, on the doorstep of, you know, essentially of this house in London, where the reader is able to get some answers about what really happened. And for me, the people left behind, the person in particular who's encountered in this scene, is a symbol of the old world. And the conversation he has with this person, who is a symbol of the new world, was so satisfying and interesting because it's clear that change is coming and people like him are not part of that change. Yeah. and stay where they are in their moment.
I found that very satisfying. Very satisfying.
I especially love the very end where the new world order really doesn't need the old world.
Yeah,
order.
Exactly. That fence post. Perfect. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Yeah. We're talking in code. That's probably.
Well, hopefully it'll make you want to read to the end.
Absolutely. I want to mention again, the name of the book is The Exiles, a novel by Christina Baker Klein, who has been my guest today, published by Custom House. Christina, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Christina Baker Klein. You can learn more about her work at christinabakerklein.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Christina Baker Klein, who suggests writing the details of part or all of your mourning and make sure to include all 5 senses in the first paragraph. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Although we thought this pandemic was about to wind down, it's now clear that it has not. I hope you're healthy and well, able to write and read, and able to follow your favorite authors despite what their launches and book tours might look like. Authors can always use support, so try to support the authors whose books are coming out. Attending their events online and in person is a great thing to do, as are reading their blogs, following their book tours, and finding your way to their books. For all of you who are trying to write these days, check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. And very often those prompts have been suggested by my guests. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, basically where you find podcasts. And you can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Finally, if you like the show, I would really appreciate it if you would rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, talk about it, tweet about it, and write to me about it. Let me know what you think. Okay, I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.